Well, lovely turnout. Thank you all for coming. And as you know, we're going to be talking about the Diamond Sutra tonight, a very key text within the Zen tradition and within the Mahayana tradition in general. And we'll probably just get to the first few lines or so by the time we actually enter into it, which is the traditional way. I think I may have mentioned this before when our ancestors, our Chinese ancestors particularly, but also the Japanese ancestors, would give a talk. They would often spend the first, week on the title, and then they move on to the first line, spend another week on that, and then kind of work their way through these texts. Would often, I think, they would take years to gradually unfold some of these longer texts. But don't worry, we won't do that. But before we launch into looking at and studying and reading a little bit about the Diamond Sutra, I'd like us first to consider why. Why should we read these sutras in the first place? Yeah, many religious traditions, and I'm thinking particularly of the Abrahamic traditions of Christianity, Islam, and the Jewish tradition, all the key texts or texts there are all revealed. In other words, they come from a divine source. And therefore, they should be studied and followed very carefully and fully. But in the Buddhist tradition, certainly for the most part, in most of the various schools in the Buddhist tradition, the sutras are not divine. They are not considered to be revealed by any kind of divine force. They are the words of a person who is awake, the words of the Buddha, or others, in a few cases, who have awakened, and as an act of compassion, leave traces for us to follow. So the sutras are like breadcrumbs, I think, for us to follow. We may consider them kind of like as guidebooks or sources of inspiration for our own practice. And they may also give us sometimes language or ways of considering what we have already experienced but have no language for. My first religious studies professor at a college, he happened to be a Roman Catholic priest, told me that he read the mystical texts of other traditions, of many other religious traditions, not to try figure out what a mystical experience was, but rather, as he read them, he said sometimes he would have glimmers. He would have the language or a phrase that he understood from his own experience. Something in his life had come forward, and these texts or a phrase or something in these texts would somehow give him language and give him insight into an experience that he had. And he wasn't talking about, big experiences. He was talking about those small ones that arise for us often. Sometimes we hardly even notice them. The sutras, these Buddhist texts, can also give us insight into the background of Buddhism, naturally, and how those who came before us practiced and how they viewed the world. And sometimes that can be insightful for us too, to have a new way of seeing our life, a new way of understanding this world, how it is unfolding. And there are other reasons as well for studying the sutras. But what we should keep, I think, in the forefront of our minds is that the sutras are not going to give us the truth. The sutras are not documents of facts or documents of doctrine that's revealed and therefore must be accepted. They are really much more simply skillful means pointing us in the right direction. They are fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the moon. I think of the sutras as more like gifts from our ancestors that aid us in avoiding pitfalls, misunderstandings, dead ends, and aids that continuously open our understanding of life, this life, your life, and our understanding of the world. Now, I've been saying this word sutra, but I hope most people have some vague idea of what I'm talking about, kind of Buddhist texts. This word sutra means a thread, and it's related to the English word of suture, right? To sew up. And when the oral teachings in the Buddhist tradition first started to be written down, scribes would write these on kind of like big leaves, these kind of dried leaves, and then these leaves would be sewn together to make like a little book that they would keep and read. Anyway, I could go on about sutras and stuff, but a final word on the sutras is that there's basically two large collections. Again, I'm just reading basically, right? There's other views and ways of understanding these, but there's two large collections of sutras in the Buddhist tradition. There's the Theravadin sutras, or suttas in Pali language, which are considered by many scholars to be the earliest texts within the Buddhist tradition. And then there's the Mahayana sutras, this kind of other mainstream of Buddhism, of which Zen is a part of. And these are written a bit later, according to scholars. But in the Buddhist tradition itself, all the sutras and suttas are considered to have been spoken by the Buddha, even though that's clearly not the case. Nevertheless, even if not spoken by the Buddha, their wisdom and insight is considered to be equal to the earliest sutras, if not greater than the earliest sutras. Does that make sense? In other words, in one way, of course, the Buddha is considered the kind of ultimate authority. In another way, there is no ultimate authority. These texts that were obviously written, composed much later than the Buddha's life, they too, though, deserve great respect and deserve to be studied for their insight that they offer about life. But the trope, the kind of understanding is that they're all spoken by the Buddha. And even the early texts, we don't know if that was actually spoken by the Buddha, because nothing was written down for several hundred years after the Buddha died. So, there are, as you can well imagine, great challenges to reading these early texts. We need to remember, first of all, that we're reading translations of very ancient languages, Sanskrit, Pali, classical Chinese, other languages, Tibetan, etc. That these texts were written for a people living in cultures long gone. And we also need to remember that there are different versions of all these texts. It's not like there's one, but there are different versions that have been passed down, slight variations. And of course, scholars love to nitpick and figure out which is the earliest. So it's pretty hard to say which version may be the really true authoritative one for many, many Buddhist texts. And yet, I strongly believe it is well worth the struggle and effort to approach these texts. And I really hope that you'll find that is the case. So, the Diamond Sutra. These are some translations, and you can have a look at these afterwards because I just need to refer to them a little bit as I do my introduction here. And there's many more. The Diamond Sutra has been translated many times into English and other European languages. It's actually not a very long text, but it's part of a collection of texts called the Mahaprajnaparamita literature, which is kind of a collection of very early Mahayana texts that focus on the teaching of emptiness, focus on the teaching of shunyata, the Sanskrit word. And I'll be talking a lot more about emptiness in the coming weeks, so I'm not going to go into it in great depth here. But emptiness, although it's a rather unfortunate word in English, but emptiness means that everything is empty of having its own true nature, its own permanent, unchanging nature. Everything is flowing in constant motion and change. Everything is intimately interwoven with everything else. Nothing stands independent. Nothing stands independent, despite our habitual way of drawing boundaries around everything. Emptiness is pointing to another truth. So that this is really important for us to understand as we go through this text. So I'll come back to it in the coming weeks. Again and again and again. Now, the traditional view of these Prajnaparamita texts, of which the Diamond Sutra is one, is that these were dictated by the historical Buddha to various disciples, but then hidden for 500 years because people weren't ready for them. And they were only rediscovered when people were ready to hear them. So that's the kind of story or myth around these texts. Scholars today, though, place this Prajnaparamita, this literature, this group of texts, as written in India around the first century, BCE, and probably were finished writing about 200 years after that. So up till about 100 in the year, in the Common Era, something like that. And the Heart Sutra that we chant almost all the time when we do a service is part of this Prajnaparamita literature. So there's a number of texts that kind of collected in this. Red Pine, who did this translation, an American scholar and poet and writer, translates the Mahaprajnaparamita as the great perfection of wisdom. The great perfection of wisdom. And wisdom in the Mahayana tradition means or refers to the deep, intimate knowledge or recognition of the interconnectedness of all things. The deep and intimate recognition of the interconnection of all things, that nothing is alone. That nothing has a permanent, unchanging nature to it. All is in flux with everything else. Within this Prajnaparamita literature, this perfection of wisdom literature, we find some other texts. We find the perfection of wisdom in 300 lines, the perfection of wisdom in 500 lines, the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, the perfection of wisdom in 18,000 lines, and perfection of wisdom in 25,000 lines. Which, when I was first researching this a long time ago, I thought, you know, those first monks who wrote down these sutras could have used a little help with the titles. The Diamond Sutra, fortunately, has that additional kind of nickname title, the Diamond Sutra, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And traditionally, these, the Heart Sutra that we chant and the Diamond Sutra are considered to be kind of distillations of these longer texts, right, trying to get this profound, intimate knowledge, like down into something like Cole's Notes. Do people know what Cole's Notes are? Yeah. I don't know if they're still available these days. And they believe that the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra maybe were written last. But scholars of these Buddhist texts, some scholars at least, believe the shorter ones actually came first, and then the longer ones came. So at university, you get to play with all this stuff and argue back and forth these matters. So the Diamond Sutra is 300 lines long. So it's the formal title would be The Perfection of Wisdom in 300 Lines. But some creative soul gave it the name the Diamond Sutra, or in Sanskrit, the Vajra Chitika Prajna Paramita Sutra. And the name is quite interesting, I think. Vajra is a kind of divine and powerful weapon. And if you are familiar at all with Tibetan Buddhism or esoteric Buddhism, there's a kind of funny little looking tool or ritual implement that has kind of like bulbs on both ends, and it represents this powerful Vajra weapon. It's described or known as a thunderbolt, in English often translated as thunderbolt. So in the Tibetan tradition particularly, we can see the use of Vajras quite a bit as they do various ceremonial procedures. But the second meaning of Vajra, or another meaning of Vajra, is diamond. Or the hard cutting properties of diamond. So Vajra means diamond. Chitika means to smash or to cut something. So a diamond that cuts, a diamond that can smash through anything. So one scholar translated this text as the perfection of wisdom that cuts like a thunderbolt. Or like a diamond. I mean, diamond seems to be the preferable translation. And I like both because when I was a young boy, I lived in England for a short time on a farm. And one summer, I saw the aftermath of an ancient large oak that had been struck by lightning. And it was shattered. It was shattered. So the Diamond Sutra is meant to do the same thing. Not to explain wisdom or to lead us into deeper wisdom, but to shatter our conceptions about ourselves, about our life, about our understanding of practice. So I think it's pretty cool to have that image. And I also like the image of a thunderbolt because I grew up mostly in Calgary on the prairies, the Canadian prairie, where in summer we would have these magnificent, magnificent thunderstorms. And I remember how at night the flashes of lightning would suddenly illuminate everything for a few seconds. So perhaps that's also at the root of this sutra, to illuminate something, illuminate our view of the world. Anyway, most scholars think that the Diamond Sutra was composed somewhere in northern India, written down around the year 200 to 300 in the Common Era, and then translated into Chinese. And this date we do know in 401. And this is the text, most of our translations actually from the Chinese, but we still have the Sanskrit texts, and they have also been translated into English. And there are some differences between the two. Anyway, translated in the year 401 by the venerated and very prolific translator Kumara Jiva. And so in the West now, we have translations from Chinese, we have translations from Sanskrit, we have translations from Tibetan as well. Now, I could go on, but I won't, because I'm sure you're eager to get into the sutra itself. But I thought a little bit of background would maybe give us a bit of a context before we dive in. But let's dive in now. So, oh, another translation of it, Chinese translation. Okay. So, I think I have enough. I made 20 copies, so I'll hand these out. And if you're planning to come back to hear more, you know, for the next kind of series, please keep them. But I would ask if you could maybe, you know, put a couple of dollars or $3 or so in the Mountain Rain box to help cover the cost of the photocopying. The translation that I selected, I did so a little bit because it was expedient for me. It's a Thich Nhat Hanh translation, which he did from the Chinese. He's a venerated Vietnamese teacher. And he also has a commentary on it. Has everyone got a cup? One? Okay. Just hang on to it for now. Yeah, that's fine. I'll collect it afterwards. So as you can see, it's actually not very long. and there's some repetition in it. Etc. And we probably won't read the whole thing together, but it's something you can easily read and say, like, you know, 20, 30 minutes on your own is, you know. But we will be looking really closely at the, for at least for 3 weeks, at the first few pages, because that's where the lightning is. So we'll be looking closely there. But let's just read. So I just pour yours for a moment here. So I want to make sure I got. Yeah. Let's just read number one together. We'll all just read this together. Because often it's nice to read these things out loud. So ready? Go.
This is what I heard one time when the Buddha was staying in the monastery in Anakapinda's park. In the Jetta Grove near Savasti, when the community of 1,250 bhikkhus, fully ordained monks. That day, when it was time to make the rounds for alms, the Buddha put on his Sangadetti robe and, holding his bowl, went to the city of Savasti to seek alms, food, going from house to house. When the alms round was completed, he returned to the monastery to eat the midday meal. Then he put away his Sangavati bowl, his bowl, washed his feet, arranged his cushion, and sat down.
Many sutras begin this way, giving us the location, the place, and those kind of things. And notice also it begins, this is what I heard. All the sutras begin with, this is what I heard, or thus I heard, or I heard thus. So it depends on the translator. And this refers to that we are listening to the cousin of the Buddha, Ananda, who was his attendant for many, many years, who had this phenomenal memory, able to memorize everything that the Buddha said, or almost everything he heard that the Buddha said. And when the Buddha died, He was then called upon by the first council of the Buddha's followers to recite what the Buddha had said. And then other people would memorize what Ananda said, and this is how the teachings were passed on from generation to generation until they were written down. And so thus I heard is Ananda beginning to recite, ah, I remember when the Buddha was at this such and such a place at such and such a time, and he said, and it begins. So like many of the other sutras, it gives us the location, who was there, the time of day that this discussion took place. So where was this? It was at Sarvasti, which was a very large city at the time. This was a time in India when cities, it was the time of the Iron Age, cities were just starting to develop. In India, it was moving away from the village culture into the city culture. There were large kingdoms forming. It was a time of kind of disruption, actually, a time of great change in society, one of those pivotal points when cultures begin to evolve and change rapidly. So it was also a time of distress for many people. Moving to the city, you know, losing their roots and things like that as well. So it was also the capital of a small kingdom. So a pretty important place. It was the practice of the Buddha and his followers at that time to wander from village to village during most of the year. But during the summer monsoons, they would stay at one place because the monsoons made it too impractical and too dangerous to wander. And one of these places was this park. Anathapindika's Park, which means benefactor's park. That's the translation, means benefactor. And he was, this benefactor was a merchant who donated this land. He paid for it and gave it to the Buddha, gave it to the Sangha, together with a wealthy prince. So there were several places where the monks would gather during the rainy season, and they would live there. And then when the rainy season passed, they would then pick up their practice of wandering. And today, you can still go there and see the ruins of that place. It's pretty clear that the Buddha was not a hermit, but he lived and traveled with his fellow monks through much of the year. And this passage also gives us a good indication of the kind of everyday routine that the Buddha did. He lived a really simple life, taking care of his own basic needs by collecting alms by himself rather than having, you know, someone else do it for him. He went out himself. And his possessions, like all people ordained at that time, were also very simple. He had two sets of robes, one a little bit more formal, one for informal times. The more formal one would be for collecting, you know, when you go out begging to say that you're begging, and you would have your bowl. And the other thing you could have was a small bag of medicine for if you got sick or came across someone who was sick. That was it. No shoes, bare feet. It was the minimum requirements for daily life. And after eating his one meal for the day, which is still the practice in ordained people in the Theravadan tradition. So if you go to Thailand or Burma, they still just eat one big meal every day. So after he put away his formal robe, he washed the dust from his feet, and then prepared to meet people. This is the most ordinary of activities, right? Eat, wash, you know, sit down, and then you know, get on with what's next. Well, next we're going to have, people are going to ask me questions? Okay. But this very simple, ordinary activity prepares us for the rest of the Diamond Sutra, demonstrating that the ordinary and the ultimate are not two. That wisdom is not separate from our daily life. The Buddha got his own food and arranged his own cushion. There's a Zen saying, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. The holy life, the life of the spirit, is not other than nor distinct from our everyday activities. In the translation by Redpine, he includes kind of snippets or commentaries by various ancient and contemporary Chinese Buddhist teachers. And I'd like to read one comment by Chang Weinung, a Buddhist scholar and practitioner who lived in the first half of the 20th century. So this is what he wrote, this commentary. Unfortunate suffering beings, the rich as well as the poor, spend their lives working for food and clothes. Do you ever feel that's what you do? Work, 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 work. No matter what kind of job they do, they all work for food. They get up in the morning and hurry to the city to work. Working for food is important. But when your work is done, you should return to your own place. The problem with most people is that for the sake of food and clothes, they run around like beggars and eventually forget who they are and no longer return to their own place. When your work is done, don't involve yourself in what doesn't concern you. Thus, the Buddha sits down and focuses on the thought before him. The Buddha sits down, having washed his feet, and is no longer thinking about tomorrow's dinner. It's just now. Just here. For the Buddha, begging for food, I think, was a kind of a ritual or a practice. He didn't ask someone else to do it for him. He did it for himself. For us, every day, we too enter the world to do work. Work for our food, our shelter, our clothing. But we also must learn how to put those things down when we return home and find our place where we are at this moment. We need to know how to turn our awareness, our attention, to what is beyond ourself and our needs, just as we need to know how to pay attention to our needs and fully engage with this world. They are both important. And further, we need to know how not to create a hierarchy. Oh, this is more important than that. Or to cling to one aspect of our life as being the most important. The practice of the Dharma and the living of our lives are not two. The practice of the Dharma and the living of our lives are not two. Well, I'm very proud of myself because not only did I get through the title, but we even got through the first chapter of this. So, a I'd like to spend just a few minutes for us together to reflect a little bit. When you come back from your everyday life, your everyday working life, whatever that is, whether you have a job or not, you know, the kind of things that keep you busy throughout the day. When you come back from the demands of your day, how can you turn your attention to what is beyond yourself and your needs? How can you turn your attention to what is beyond yourself and your needs? And what does that mean to you?